This is the Bridge of the Faithful podcast, featuring your host, Jenna Erlandson.
Hey guys, and welcome to the Bridge of the Faithful podcast. I'm Jenna, and we're all traveling this faithful bridge together. These episodes are just my documentation of the things that God is showing me as I search to understand what faithfulness really means. You can find this and all other episodes at botfpodcast.com. You can also connect with me at facebook.com/botfpodcast. And I am here today. We're still continuing on this creativity series, and I am here with Austin Jaquith, who is a professor at Cedarville teaching composition of music, right? Composition?
Mm-hmm. Music composition.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about that and what else you do with that.
Well, primarily I write music for a number of different purposes. I started out writing what we would term concert music, you know, music that just gets played in a concert hall and an audience shows up and listens to it. And then everybody more or less forgets it. And there's a lot of skills there in just what instruments are like, how to create sheet music for them. And I've done a lot of that kind of composing. And I've also more recently tried my hand at some film scoring. I've done a couple feature films and some documentaries, and that's much more of a technological feat than a feat of working with real musicians. There's a lot of computer technology and simulating instruments, and those are my two primary main things that I do. Concert, mostly instrumental, some vocal works, and then film scores as well.
How'd you get into film?
Well, when I started teaching at Cedarville, I had done none of this and realized that a lot of my students were either interested in game scoring or film scoring. And I didn't know the first thing about either of those. And so I thought, well, I have the resources here to try it out. There's a fair amount of initial cost for the equipment, which is somewhat of a deterrent. But I thought, well, hey, Cedarville's going to have to foot that bill if they want me to teach this stuff. So why not give it a go? And I did. I went to some conferences and tried to meet as many directors as I can and did some smaller projects, which led to some bigger projects and which, you know, you just keep hoping to find, you know, a new thing to work on that was bigger and better than the last. And so far that's been the trajectory. So yeah, it was a lot of just trying to meet people. It was one hand of it. And then the other was just trying to get your mind around all the technical skills that you needed to translate music from what I had done into how to get it on a screen, or at least in on the audio track for a film or something like that.
So going way back, how did you first learn about your talent in music and then into composition?
Well, I started playing the clarinet and just really took to it. The only small problem was that in our band in middle school there was 1,000 clarinetists. And so the band director steered me, he said, why don't you play the saxophone? And I said, sure. I mean, I didn't have any objection to it. So the first instrument that I picked up was a clarinet. The first instrument that I studied, you know, seriously was the saxophone. And I don't actually know why, but I just was intrigued by the idea of writing down notes and composing. My band director gave me a music score for a very iconic piece. It's called Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And I would listen to it and watch the notes go by. And I was just fascinated how these I wouldn't have said these words when I was, you know, in middle school, but these abstract symbols, when brought to life, just made such a magnificent sound. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I just really wanted to be able to do that, write a symphony like Beethoven did.
That's cool.
And so, yeah, it was just an interest that sort of fed itself through middle and high school and then college and continuing through today.
When did you really start getting into composing where you had an audience?
Actually, all the way back in middle school, one of the bigger projects I did, I can't remember all the details, but we had this history production. My U.S. history class, we did this wide-ranging production. And my part was to create an arrangement of When Johnny Comes Marching Home. And so I created this arrangement, and I can't even remember who came to watch this concert or show or whatever it was. But that was the first thing I did. And then in high school, I wrote several pieces for our symphonic band that would be played in the concerts. We took it to a festival once, And every summer I was part of a music camp. And at the end of the two to three summers there, I wrote an orchestral piece, you know, got all the students together, and in our final concerts, that was part of the concert. So pretty soon after I started writing notes, I started presenting this music publicly.
What does it feel like when you get inspiration?
Well, let me just talk a little bit about what I think inspiration is.
Great.
That's sort of a mythical kind of thing. You know, maybe a popular view of it is just being taken over by some, you know, unseen force and creating with no effort whatsoever. And I think that's a little misleading. I tend to think of creativity, it's when you see the possibilities in ideas or in things. You know, music's a little strange because it's an abstract medium. You know, if you're a painter or a potter or a sculptor, the materials you're working with, you can see them and you can feel them and you can touch them. And so you can literally see something in a piece of stone or in clay. And in music, of course, when we say seeing possibilities in the ideas, it's sort of an abstract level of seeing. But in any case, you know, you have some basic ideas. And if you're not inspired, then those ideas just seem uninteresting and they seem to have no possibilities. And they don't excite you in any way. And when you're in a more, I don't know, inspired state or having inspiration, whatever the right verb might be, you know, when you see a simple idea, you see possibilities that idea has to become more than it is right now. And that's when I think often the best creation happens is when you're excited about the materials that you have. You're seeing all kinds of things that could be done with them. Often you're seeing way more things to do with these ideas than you could ever possibly have time to execute in the current project. And so you choose the best ones. And when you compare the state of being uninspired and seeing no possibilities in your materials versus the state of feeling inspired and excited and encouraged and enthusiastic about these materials, I mean, it's obviously far preferable to create under those circumstances. Although, you know, if you're doing any kind of creativity that's time bound, sometimes you can't wait for so-called inspiration. Sometimes you just have to plod along and generate force ideas, as it were, out if you don't have any good ones. But that's how I would term inspiration. And it's just seeing possibilities in ideas.
Awesome. So for you, do you find a melody first and then go from there? Or do you have like a couple of measures that you hear and then you want to build on that? What do you?
All of the above. Yeah, okay. I have music has a lot of facets. If we break it down to just real simple, a real simple list. And you've got melody, you've got harmony, you have rhythm, and you have texture, and you have form. And really an idea for a piece could come from any of those angles. You know, you could have a couple of chords that you really liked, the way they one follows another. That could be a main idea. So sometimes, yeah, pieces I've created have been based strictly on those one, two, three, maybe four chords. There's tunes. So sometimes I'll definitely create pieces where the tune was the first piece that I generated. Or it might just be a color, you know, some high woodwinds mixed with pizzicato strings or a warbling synthesizer down low mixed with who knows what, bass clarinet, I don't know. And so really any dimension of the musical syntax can be the seed for an idea. And I definitely have started pieces starting from any one of those, from those entry points.
Do you have a favorite piece that you've done?
Oh, that's a really good question. I have a few favorites. One is I set the Magnificat text for a chamber orchestra and soprano. And that piece was very meaningful for me. It was a follow-up to a setting of Psalm 22, which just wasn't as successful as I'd hoped as an artistic piece. And so setting this Magnificat text in a way that was much more satisfactory kind of felt very redeeming. And I'd always wanted to do a sacred vocal work that I could really sink my teeth into. And so with this Magnificat, I succeeded. Another piece I wrote called Blaze of Autumn, it was just purely an orchestral work. And that was one of my favorites just because it was the final piece I wrote as a doctoral student. It was very technically difficult. I got this great recording from the Indiana University Orchestra, and I just pushed everything I knew to do to the absolute limits, which you don't get to do in most situations. You know, there's all kinds of limitations. You know, the players only have this much time to rehearse. They don't have infinite technical capabilities. The audience may not even appreciate what you're writing here. But this particular piece didn't have those kinds of constraints at all, so I was able to just do what I wanted. And I was it was great fun. And so, yeah, I would maybe cite the Magnificat and this Blaze of Autumn piece I mentioned as two of my favorites.
Some of the other people I've interviewed are authors. So they, like, we can find their books. Where could we find your pieces? Do you have them on
those
YouTube?
Those two pieces, or? I believe, are up on my website,
okay.
www.austinkjakewith.com. I'm going to check that actually real quick. There's, yep, Blaze of Autumn is right there. And I have an excerpt from the Magnificat. It's 30 minutes long, so I have 10 minutes of it. Okay. I have 10 minutes of it up there.
How long does it take you to write something that long?
That can vary drastically. The Magnificat text, let's see, I do not remember precisely. I'm guessing it was 4 to 5 months that I spent on that.
Okay.
And, you know, there's very different kinds of writing. If we just compare like a symphony with a film score, for instance, you know, the symphony has no givens. Every note has to be, have purpose in and of itself. The form has to develop according to some internal procedure the composer is setting up, versus like a film score where, you know, the visuals determine much of the, to just determine the shape of the music a lot. And so the symphonic music is going to be much more detailed, much more complex. The film music is going to be less detailed, less complex. And so when you're talking about genres that don't deal with a lot of complexity, they can be written much faster than what we would term art music, where there's an expectation for a high degree of cautious consideration for every detail that you put in the score. And so, yeah, Blaze of Autumn and Magnificat, you know, I would spend, for the 10-minute piece, I probably spent 5 months, 4 months, and for this 30-minute piece, 5 or 6 months. Compare that to, you know, a film score where you have 3 months to generate 45 minutes of music. It's just a very different challenge there. So yeah, it depends on the level of complexity and the density of the music, really, how long it's going to take.
For you personally, with the freedom of kind of your own interpretation of things versus a film score, where do they give you a scene and then you have to fit the mood for that, or how
exactly.
do they?
That's exactly how. Okay. It works. Yep, you hopefully get the film completed is the best time to start a film score. And then yes, you just track along with what they already have there. So you're just amplifying what's already there.
Okay.
And you're following the shape that's already there. And also the music is just one element of, you know, dialogue and sound effects. And so it's not going to be nearly as thick, because it would overwhelm the rest of the film. So it's much more sparse and skeletal in general. Okay. When you're doing film scores.
Gotcha. When you're making, whether it's your own, not your own music, it's all your own music, but if it's something that's your own inspiration versus having guidelines for what they want you to represent, how does God impact your creation in that?
Right. That's a great question. And it's one that I'm always wondering about myself. My take on this is that, you know, Christian artists work in every genre and medium imaginable. So, I mean, if we just look at music, you have Christians involved in pop genres, and you have Christians involved in abstract genres, and you have Christians involved in film scoring. And these are all very different ways of composing and creating. And in every case of a successful Christian artist in these mediums, it's hard to pinpoint technical differences between the Christian version and the non-Christian version, as it were. So in other words, the technical considerations for that genre remain the same. There's no Christian way to have a good film, you know, when it comes to color, for instance. But I think that the big difference is, what are you writing for, and the why, and also, you know, to what end do you want this work to create? That's where I find that it most significantly impacts what I'm doing. And so, you know, this summer I wrote an orchestral piece for the Cedarville Orchestra, and I wrote it on the creation narrative. And I just called it "And There Was Light." And so the subject matter was the thing that was influenced by my belief in God, by my love of God, by my wanting to turn, you know, these meager talents I have back towards Him. The technical part, though, you know, how I worked out the notes and all that, it's really hard to pinpoint what exactly a Christian faith influences there, I think. So I would say that it's more in the purpose, the type of project you do, and the goals that you have. That's where the biggest effect is, as opposed to the more minutia of, you know, how do you write a chord progression? You know, chord progressions that affect us in certain ways, that's an issue of craft and technique. And it's really, I think, tough to actually identify Christian technique, so to speak. There are simply techniques which produce certain effects and other techniques which produce others. And by choosing which techniques you're using, you communicate ideas. And it's those ideas that I think where the Christian faith influences at least me and probably most Christian artists the most.
So besides that, what are some other barriers for you when you're trying to create?
Yeah, I think there's more barriers to creation than there are paths. so there's just the simple difficulty of just starting something. And, you know, I think the difference oftentimes between people who call themselves creative and those that and make stuff and those that don't is simply the quote unquote creative people, they took it one step further from the talk and they tried to do it. And that is one of the most daunting things. You know, you've never written a piece, and now you're going to try to do it. It's excruciating. And, you know, while I've gotten over those initial hurdles, confronting nothingness, we'll just call it nothingness for now. Confronting nothingness and trying to put something there, confronting a blank page is extremely daunting. And, there's a difficulty of getting ideas that satisfy yourself, for one. And two, you know, the more you climb a ladder in any artistic medium, the more you have a sense of the other art that's been created in that medium and how great it is. And it's very difficult, you know, when yours doesn't measure up. You think, well, this is so far from that Beethoven Fifth Symphony that I wanted to create. You know, is there even any point in writing these notes? And so, yeah, there's so many barriers of getting discouraged and feeling like there's no point, and you know, just simple things like feeling tired and foggy headed when you're trying to come up with ideas and looking at your melody that you've created as the foundation and just seeing nothing there, you know, just seeing it as boring and lifeless and pathetic. And it might not be any of those things, but that's your perspective at the time. And the net result is it is very difficult to create things. And that's just the mental process. And then of course there's the practical barriers. If you write a piece, if you want to complete the circle, so to speak, you've got to have someone play this. So you need to find someone that's capable to play it, and you need to try to schedule them to rehearse. You need to find a concert to put it on. Maybe you need to find an ensemble to play it. And all these things take just enormous amounts of effort. And also having people tell you no constantly, no, I can't play your piece. You know, no, I don't want to play your piece. You know, no, you didn't win. No, this, no, that. And it's very, of course, discouraging for anyone. And, so the people that keep doing it, it's because they don't quit and not necessarily anything else, I think, in many cases.
So on the other side of that, when you felt that discouragement, that getting all the no's, what has pushed you? What things have encouraged you to keep going?
Well, I sometimes joke that being a composer is a disease that I have and that no matter what I try to do to shed this disease, I can't help it. So there, for me personally, honestly, there's a compulsion there that I can't explain. And perhaps it's just, you know, perhaps it's just God himself just wanted me to compose. I think that's very possible. But I have always just wanted to do it. So even if I'm discouraged today, when I wake up tomorrow, I may still be discouraged, but I can't quit. And there were several times, you know, along the way that I seriously considered just dropping it all. In my doctoral studies, I was a piano tuner, and there was a job opening at a college. And I considered very strongly in taking an interview there and hopefully becoming a full-time piano tuner. And my wife talked me out of it. But every time I've considered seriously, should I just quit? I cannot imagine quitting. And so there's that aspect there. And then just from sort of my internal encouragement to myself, you know, I do assume, I mean, I think calling can be challenging. Some people feel very strongly called to do things and they just know. I can't say that I've ever felt incredibly strongly a sense that, yes, God has called you to do composition. You know, I like it. I love it. And I can't seem to stop doing it. And I seem to be decent at it. And I certainly prayed a lot before I embarked on music school. But I never, you know, got an abundantly clear piece of confirmation, I would say. And so barring that, some of my internal encouragement has just been thinking about famous artists of the past and the fact that their paths have often been very circuitous. We all love J.R.R. Tolkien, of course. And one of the things I remember being just struck by reading about him was, you know, on his holiday, so to speak, you know, he needed extra money for his kids' tuition for their school or whatever. And so he was grading extra essays for extra cash. You know, and here's this author that's going to write one of the best series of novels ever written. And he's, you know, grading banal essays in his time off when he should be, you know, reading great books and getting encouraged. And so, you know, I remind myself that, you know, when God calls us to do something, he doesn't call us and tell us, I'm going to make it perfect and wonderful in every way for you. That's not how callings tend to be worked out. They tend to be worked out in struggle and in discouragement often. And I figure if J.R.R. Tolkien can grade essays, you know, I can be patient too. And also I you know, took a while to get there, but I've just come to the realization we can't all be number one. You know, we all can't be Beethoven. We all can't be Bach, but you know, we all can't be James McMillan. We all can't be John Williams, but there's contributions to be made that are at levels other than the number one level. And if that weren't the case, we'd all just have to quit and go home. Because there's just not that many John Williams. There's one actually. And so those expectations of just pie in the sky success, I think are detrimental. And we have to kind of temper them and try to enjoy the process of creating outside of expectations of kind of the American, the artist equivalent of the American dream where, you know, you write one thing and it takes off and you're asked to do another and another and another and another. And everything you do just opens this, you know, family tree, so to speak, of five other things. And, you know, that's not the where most of us get to live. And so I remind myself of that constantly, probably every day. And you just have to keep going. If you want to, you know, succeed in the sense of having a technical control and creating music that you deem beautiful and creating music or whatever medium that you want to, you know, thank God and honor God and point to God through. So yeah, anyway, those are some of the things that I'll think about when I'm feeling, yes, very discouraged, which, I mean, I think it happens to me all the time. And I'm sure that that's somewhat common among artists.
I'm actually really excited because before we do this series, I've got another mini series on talents to kind of lead into creativity and talking about how we're called to not bury them, but invest in them And it's hard when you've got all these giants of success that you look at and compare to in social media, where you see where other people are in their particular journey at the time.
Yeah.
And just being able to continue investing in that, even if you don't feel like you're getting the dividends that you're wanting.
Yes. And it is very difficult.
Yeah. So thanks for that. That really spoke to a lot of what I'm trying to encourage people on. So it's good to hear from other people that I'm not saying wrong things, or that I know I'm not the only one feeling that way.
No.
So you kind of got into this, but with your music, is there any specific attribute that you want to reflect of God, or is it dependent on each piece?
Yeah, there's probably no general statement I could make that would apply to every single piece. But you know, the way I try to describe it, rather than reflecting God, I use the terminology point to. I am very hesitant to claim the mantle of reflecting God, just because, you know, God is magnificent and he is who he is. And like I said, I feel uncomfortable attempting even to reflect. And so I like to think I try to point to God with my music in some way. And for any just standalone project that I'm doing just cause, that's usually the goal, is have that be a foundation. And a lot of the pieces that if you examine a lot of the pieces that I've written, you can usually find one or two slivers at least. The two vocal pieces that I mentioned, the setting of Psalm 22 and the setting of the Magnificat text, there it's fairly overt. You know, I took God's words themselves and then spoke, and then had my piece essentially accompanying God's words. And so, you know, I'm pointing to God through God's own words himself. And then the music, you know, I tried to set it so that the music was somewhat fitting to those words. So that's one way. The piece I mentioned, Blaze of Autumn, I was definitely thinking, well, first of all, the piece itself, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but it was about just how beautiful fall is, you know, and there's all kinds of reds and yellows and orange leaves everywhere. And it's just this glorious blaze of color. And I was very cognizant writing the piece that I was celebrating in this piece something beautiful that God had created. Or in this piece, you know, and there was light, you know, just I was reflecting musically and just trying to impart just a tiny piece of that awe we all get when we, you know, look into the sky, see all these planets and stars and solar systems, seeing the vast size of it and just imagining that beginning. And just, so I was trying to get aside that, you know, get across some of that awe that I felt and have felt, like I said, looking at the sky. And so most of the pieces I decided to do have some element like that. And, you know, the other music, when you're writing for someone else, it's much more just, it tends to be just, it's their idea. So you're working to do their ideas. I do try to, and, you know, in any way I can, to put my faith in the work that I do. So for instance, I did a ballet score for the Dayton Ballet, Dracula Bloodlines. And the one little sliver that I kind of inserted there is we had this character named Lilith, and she's a creature from Jewish mythology. And I won't get into the details, but she played this malevolent role in the ballet, and it was a ballet opera hybrid. So we had some arias. So when I wrote lyrics for Lilith, I basically imagined her as Satan, and I said things from her perspective. The words that came out of her mouth were basically things I imagined Satan might be saying. And so there was an aspect that, you know, even though it was a fun Halloween ballet was what it is. I mean, that was the main purpose, just entertainment for people in Dayton to enjoy the wonderful dancing of the Dayton Ballet, enjoy a good story. But I tried to insert this kind of theological perspective of what the kinds of things Satan might say to somebody who had been deceived by him. And I put those words into the mouth of Lilith. And so, you know, when I have opportunities, I do that. And when I don't, you know, I just write the music the best I can for that particular project.
Is it hard to like read interpretations or to see interpretations of your work?
I would say if you don't know about the interpretations beforehand, they would not be particularly obvious.
Okay.
Especially with purely instrumental works, like, you know, with a piece like Blaze of Autumn. That title does not, of course, get across all my behind the scenes thoughts. So, yeah, I would say that the interpretation is going from listening to the work, interpreting the work, and then coming to the conclusions that were my original thoughts would be quite difficult.
When you saw on stage the dancers, was it, did you have any say in the direction?
Not in the choreography.
Okay.
The director there, Karen Russo Burke, was actually quite generous in letting me work with her on the libretto.
Okay.
And she gave me a fair degree of latitude with each individual scene. For instance, she would just say, you know, here's a battle scene between the warring sides. And then I would get to kind of pick the, how the scenes unfolded. And then we talked a lot about it. So she, you know, it was her, she was the librettist and it was her project, but she definitely listened to quite a bit of input from me. And I appreciated that.
What's it feel like to sit in the audience and hear your music being played by someone else?
It's quite exhilarating, especially when it's going well. And it's a very heady experience. There's no doubt about it. Yeah, sitting there for the first four performances of Dracula Bloodlines in 2017 or 16. And then also this past in 2008, fall 2018. It was wonderful. It was, it's, there's nothing quite like it. And it's probably another one of the reasons why we do it again, even though it's difficult, is watching a culmination of months and months and months and months and months of work finally unfold. Yes, it's wonderful.
So my last big question, a lot of the themes, the, as you heard from the intro, the big idea of my podcast was talking about faithfulness, both what it means for us to be faithful to God and what God's faithfulness to us looks like. And that was the beginning of this journey of this podcast. But a lot of it has turned into where we place our identity.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the themes in this specific series is that God is creative and he made us in his image, and therefore he made us to create as well. So do you feel mm-hmm. like that's part of your identity? How would you put your identity in a creative standpoint? Did that
right.
make sense?
Yeah, I thought this was a great thing to bring up because, you know, we live in the century of identity.
Yeah.
Identity is everything for most people.
Yep.
And certainly when I was in conservatory, you saw that. People's identity was music. Their religion was music. They
yeah.
eat, breathed, practiced, and worshiped music. And, you know, after years and years of both experiencing other people's struggles, seeing their pain, and my own, I have concluded that it's actually a very dangerous thing to put your identity in your creative self.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not encourage my students to do that. You know, it's perhaps sounds like a cliche, but it's true. You know, as Christians, our identity should be in Christ. And if we put our identity anywhere else, you inevitably run into trouble. And so what I found is, you know, when you put your identity in being a creative individual, it ends up being just an absolute unbearable burden, because, you know, the creative part of you is often not well regarded by people around you. It's prone to failure, both from a technical standpoint, like you write a bad piece, which happens more often than we would like to admit. And so if your identity is in that, then your failure is a failure of your identity. It's a pointing out the flaws of your identity. And so, you know, what you see is that people who are consumed with their identity as creative artists are often very unhappy, because because as creative people, we're inevitably going to see our weaknesses in what we create. There may be some exceptions, but for most of us, that's going to be the case. And so I encourage my students and myself to think of, number one, your identity has to be in Christ. And think of being creative as something that God lets us do. It gives us joy. And in some way, we're imitating him when we do that, you know, as small c creators. And if we approach it from that standpoint, that this is an activity, creating is an activity that God has wired me for, and that I enjoy doing, and I love doing, and I think I can love my neighbor with this, so I'm going to do it. If that's your reasoning, then even if things go really awry, you haven't been cut to the core. But if everything about you is, I'm a composer, I'm a poet, it was an absolutely unbearable burden for me. And one of the most important things I ever did was try to distance myself from having my identity be in creativity. And then, you know, there's just the aspect, you know, I'm very fortunate. I get up every day. I get to compose almost every single day and, you know, teach too. And I get to do the creative work that I love. But not every one of us is necessarily going to be that fortunate. You know, you could live in a third world country and have terrific flair for composing, but you're not going to compose, you know, you're going to be trying to survive. And so, I think if we see creativity as a gift rather than an identity, we're going to be on much more solid ground, both psychologically in terms of depression, but also just theologically in our understanding of when God gives us something, what does that mean? I just find that to be a far safer way to see it.
Yeah. That's exactly where I'm coming to with that. So that's, you said that way better than I ever could. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
So at the end, we always talk about a verse that kind of sums up the point of the episode, and you have chosen yours. So why don't you introduce it?
So the verse that I chose comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and it's part of a discussion on, you know, how to handle eating meat sacrificed to idols and how to handle living in a world and not being of it. And so, of course, I'm a composer, not a chef, or in this, I guess, an eater. but, you know, the question there is just, what should I do? And the answer is, well, eat or drink, but do it to the glory of God and make sure that that's the foundational motivation. And if you can do that, you'll probably come up with the right answer. And so, you know, when we practice music, there's a lot of what should we do that we could ask about. You know, should I write in an abstract medium? Should I write popular music? Should I be a commercial composer? Should I try to be an art music composer? You know, should I be a music teacher? Should I? Well, it's very difficult to answer those questions precisely, and God is probably not going to send you an email with the precise answer. And so I think what most of us are left doing is saying, okay, I don't know precisely what I should do, but I think that if I choose something and I mean to glorify God with it, that's probably going to be the best I can do, and that's probably going to be pleasing to him. And so anyway, I pull out this particular verse, which I guess you were going to read, yeah, to sort of encapsulate that idea.
So before I end, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to share this wisdom and kind of give us a glimpse into the life of a composer, and just seeing where God shows up in all different types of creative realms and genres.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. We're going to end with 1 Corinthians 10:31. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God.
Amen.
This has been episode 25 of the Bridge of the Faithful podcast entitled Created to Create with composer Austin Jaquith. For show notes, go to botfpodcast.com/episode/25. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/botfpodcast.